Hello, everyone. Welcome to Talking Logistics, where we and newsmakers in the supply chain logistics industry. And it's my great pleasure to welcome today's program, Sri Lakshmana from C.H. Robinson and Jennifer Bratton from the Boston Consulting Group. And today we're going to talk about the Panama Canal expansion, the impact on logistics strategies and operations. Now, the Panama Canal expansion has been a topic that there's been a lot discussed and a lot been written about in terms of what impact it's going to have on logistics operations in the coming years. And that's the question that a recent study that was conducted by C.H. Robinson and the Boston Consulting Group kind of undertook to kind of really understand kind of the different scenarios and different implications of the expansion and what it will have on logistics operations and strategies. And we're privileged to have with us today Sri Lakshmana from C.H. Robinson and Jennifer Bratton from the Boston Consulting Group. Both of them participated in the research and they're authors of the study. So today we're going to kind of dive a little bit deeper into some of the key findings from the research and the study and try to understand kind of what shippers, carriers, 3PLs ought to be doing next as a result. Just a reminder, part of our goal here at Talking Logistics is to make this conversational. So if you do have a question for Sri or Jennifer as we're having our conversation here, you can do so via the post a question button down the bottom or via the chat feature. And I'll keep an eye on that. And if it's a good and appropriate question, I'll try to weave it into the conversation. Finally, if you are joining us as a visitor, you will have to sign in first in order to ask a question. So with that, Sri, Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Adrian. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So, Sri, why don't we start with you, and let's start with a very basic, question. What led you to initiate, this research project, and what was the main goal in doing it?
Well, there has been a lot of chatter last year when the ILWU and PMA discussion went sour, for lack of better terms. This chatter revolved around customers wanting options aside the U.S. West Coast to better manage their supply chain and avoid the constant uncertainty every 5 to 6 years when the contracts are renegotiated. We also consistently heard about the Panama Canal expansion in many forums, articles, and just the general industry chatter. But I think we've never really saw an in-depth analysis on what it meant for specific verticals or customers, especially on how this expansion would impact them. So really, our main goal is to create a level of awareness on what the canal expansion will potentially create and would be an alternate routing and options to customers, and more importantly, a cost-competitive manner.
Yeah, I would add to that, just stressing the point around the analysis. There's been lots of articles and research, but very few people dimensionalizing the impact. And we certainly aren't suggesting we have the magic answer, but we've definitely come out with a little bit of a perspective, assuming a set of variables around the size of what that impact could be, which actually really starts to put a little bit of a framework around it going forward.
Yeah, no, I think that that's a good those are good points. A lot of times, it's easy to hypothesize and go with gut feelings in terms of what might happen, right? And I think what I liked most in reading the report is that this at least you guys put some rigor to it, if you will, or you put some structure around it to at least point companies, shippers, 3PLs, and anyone that could be affected by this. Provide them with some scenarios and provide them with some context, if you will, to be able to really more thoroughly think through the implications here. So with that in mind, Jennifer, I mean, can you talk a little bit about how you went about kind of developing the model, what factors and assumptions went into it?
Of course. So the model looked from a scope perspective at container traffic coming from East Asia. There's lots of flows coming in, but we wanted to isolate a certain segment so that we could go deep and really be robust in that segment. And what we did was we looked at all sorts of input variables. So from a demand perspective, we look not only at demand projections going forward for U.S. container demand, but we also looked at demand shifts moving in terms of where that demand is going to sit within the U.S., which we see a little bit of a shift heading down into the Southeast region, and so we modeled that in as well. We looked at capacity, and so we went deep into the port capacities that exist today, what ports were planning to add into the future that they had put into publicly available data, as well as rail capacity going forward. And we integrated those current state and additions into the model. We then looked at costs, and these costs included everything from rail costs and trucking costs in the U.S. We looked at the costs through the Panama Canal from a toll perspective. And we also looked at energy costs, because obviously over the water is much more favorable as energy prices go up. And so we wanted to integrate all those variables into the model so that we could flex them in different scenarios. And once we did that, we looked at a momentum case without the Panama Canal, so sort of created a set of assumptions going forward on all those variables. And then we flexed off of that momentum case, saying, well, what would happen to the flow when the Panama Canal expansion hits, which, as we all know, is going to result in a large capacity increase in the Panama Canal, but more importantly, a decrease of up to, we estimated, 30% in the slot costs going through the Panama Canal. And we saw where that demand naturally wanted to shift across the ports based solely on cost. And obviously, nobody has a crystal ball into the future against all those variables. And so we created a set of scenarios going forward that are all documented in the article that simply lay out, different scenarios into the future, but all scenarios that we think could be possible so that we could understand how we expect the answer to swing based on those different scenarios.
Great, great. And so just quick follow up there. So some of the data that you use third party data in terms of the forecast for container growth and thing and rail and things like that. How did you use some of the numbers or some of the forecasts? Where did those come from?
Yep. So it was a mix of data that BCG had internally as it related to container flows from prior research that we've done, a mix of publicly available data when it comes to things like port capacity expansion. We leveraged a lot of the data that C.H. Robinson had as it looks at rail costs and trucking costs. So it was really a collaborative effort across both of us to combine all of the inputs into the model.
Great. So let me kind of go into, one of the interesting findings from the research, and that is, it showed that up to 10% of container traffic, to the U.S. from East Asia could shift from West Coast ports to the East Coast by 2020. I think that was kind of the headline, that a lot of folks gravitated toward. And one of the interesting findings is that, let me quote from the report here, the battleground on which U.S. ports compete for customers will move several hundred miles west to a region that accounts for more than 15% of GDP. What does that mean exactly? So Jen, why don't you go first, and maybe Sri, you can add to that.
Of course. Well, today, two-thirds of the volume coming from the East Coast goes into the West Coast ports, and it is still going to remain the fastest way to get goods into the U.S. But what we've teed up in the model and what the output told us was essentially the decline in costs going through the Panama Canal will actually shift what we're calling the battleground line in the U.S. of where it actually becomes more cost efficient to bring goods through the Panama Canal and into the East Coast and then truck or rail them in versus going into the West Coast and trucking or railing them from the West Coast ports. And so that line of where you sort of have the cost neutrality, given the decline in Panama Canal, will start to shift westward and include then places like Columbus and Memphis and Detroit, which historically we've seen more favorable for West Coast receipt, will now become more cost effective going into the East Coast ports. And so that's where you see that line shifting. And within that, we've roughly approximated the GDP. I mean, on a map, it doesn't look like a large shift, but it's actually quite a lot of demand in GDP that sits in that that boundary area.
Yeah, and obviously I'll add to that. Now, when we look at the battleground region, right? I mean, through the paper, it primarily hits Memphis, Columbus, Chicago, and Detroit. So really, to simplify it, today's routing to these locations are primarily from the West Coast areas. So either the PSW or PNW ports. So really, post canal expansion, you know, it's our belief that for some specific customers, it will make more sense to possibly route cargo to the U.S. East Coast in a competitive manner, to Jen's point earlier. So really, you know, we keep mentioning that in the paper for specific customers because the transit will undoubtedly be slightly longer, so it might not fit all verticals. But really, when we look at the U.S. East Coast routings for Rivers IPI locations today, it predominantly goes to maybe Pittsburgh, Charlotte, the Atlanta area. But really, post-expansion, that's what we mean by moving a few hundred miles west, because it would include beyond those areas to include Memphis, Columbus, Chicago, Detroit. So really, it'll make more sense to route cargo from the East Coast. It's just solely depending on the West Coast.
Yeah, no, I think that was one of the interesting findings, you know, for me to, you know, at first I thought, wait a minute, what do you mean? You know, I was so used to the headline of things moving east, and then you said things, you know, the shift is going to move it west. I had to kind of read that section again to fully understand what you were talking about. But I can see now, basically, the idea here is that, you know, these commerce centers, you know, these relatively large cities now have, you know, the from a cost standpoint, you know, bringing it into the East Coast makes them, could, depending on your industry, make a lot more sense under this scenario than it would under, you know, the existing, you know, flows that they're going through. So Sheree, kind of to build off of that, I mean, what impact will this shift have, you know, from the West Coast ports to the East Coast ports on the leading ports on both coasts, you know, such as LA, Long Beach, New York, New Jersey, you know, Charleston? I mean, are there clear kind of winners and losers here?
Well, Adrian, really, I don't think so. There'll be a clear-cut winners or losers with the expansion, but I think we feel a few ports will have more to gain from the expansion in contrast to the others. When you speak about the West Coast, it'll continue to be a dominant gateway into the U.S., just given how geography is in terms of distance from the Far East. Nothing's going to change that, and I think there are many positive attributes to that distance. But when we look at the U.S. West Coast ports, some of the PNW and PSW ports, I mean, they have deeper channels and they have logic rates to needed to handle the bigger vessels. But the constant uncertainty during the contract discussion, especially this last one, is what's driving the need for diversity. And really directly benefiting the eastern ports, who are aggressively competing with one another for market share. So, you know, I think we mentioned in the paper as well, I mean, the most important thing in real estate that we know today, right? It's location, location, location. You know, same holds true for the ports. So our model anticipates specific ports on the East Coast, such as, you know, New York, New Jersey, Norfolk, Savannah, Charleston. I mean, all these ports stand to gain more by virtue of the, you know, their relative proximity to the defined battleground areas that I mentioned earlier, and attractive routings from these ports compared to the others. So really, we're not undermining the other ports, but we do feel the few ports that we mentioned stands to gain the most.
Yeah, you brought up, you know, kind of risk management, you know, as a way to kind of the way a lot of shippers are looking at this. And I agree. I mean, I was just at a conference recently where William Sonoma talked about the impact that the West Coast port shutdown had on their operations, you know, as a large retailer. And, you know, they were less, you know, they were impacted, but they were less impacted than others, just because they had for some time had this diversification strategy, if you will, where they were bringing things, they weren't heavily concentrated just on LA Long Beach. They were, you know, dispersed along the West Coast, but they were also dispersed along the East Coast as well, which helped to kind of mitigate, you know, some of the impact nonetheless. So I think that's a, you know, key reason why a lot of, shippers are kind of looking at this, and a key reason why I think a lot of the ports, particularly on the East Coast, as you said, are making these investments and kind of positioning themselves as a way to not only from a cost perspective, but saying, hey, you know, from a risk management standpoint, you know, diversification where it makes sense, it should be something you should be looking at. You know, Jennifer, going back to you now, you know, in the report, you know, the report highlights, you know, various factors or trade-offs that companies, you know, must consider when evaluating East Coast ports versus West Coast ports, you know, namely time, cost, and flexibility. Can you elaborate on how those factors impact the decision-making process for shippers?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I've talked about, the model and the analysis we've talked about today is really focused on cost. But the reality is, in an operating environment, companies care more about more than just cost. And so the question is really, to what extent is a company sensitive to cost or not, in which case this would have more of an impact on whether they go into the West Coast or the East Coast. And so in order to demonstrate the impact of this trade-off, we chose four commodities. We looked at couches, we looked at tires, we looked at t-shirts, and we looked at industrial pumps. And you might say, well, that's an interesting collection of products, but it is representative of the bulk of the type of goods that we bring in via container into the U.S. from East Asia. And what we did was based on our analysis and looking at what percent of transportation costs, you know, is comprised within the COGS bucket of all of those, the answer actually looks different. And so, you know, a product where you've got a lot of money wrapped into the shipping cost is going to be a lot more sensitive to that declining cost savings associated with going through the Panama Canal. And therefore, potentially that trade-off of having to wait an additional 11 days, 10 days to go through the Panama Canal, and including the inventory that you have to hold to accommodate not only the in-transit inventory, but also the additional safety stock to absorb the volatility while you have more goods in transport, doesn't come close to even netting out that transportation savings that you gain. And so for things like tires and couches, it would be a much easier logical shift to say, absolutely, as long as I'm not time sensitive for other reasons, I would go through the Panama Canal because that cost savings is a much larger benefit to me than the additional inventory carrying costs. The answer looks different for t-shirts and industrial pumps, where the transportation component is a much smaller part of the overall COGS for that product. And therefore, even if there's a marginal savings, the belief is the additional inventory would be higher. And for things like t-shirts, you also have things to consider such as the time element. So fashion, getting things quickly is going to be a lot more important in the fashion industry. And you just can't, there's no substitution for getting things there quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I'll add a little bit on that. Really, I think Jen you know, really touched on all the bases, you know, on the commodities that we represented, which are the top most important categories into the U.S. But really, what it boils down to, you know, undoubtedly, again, when I mentioned earlier about the geography aspect of it, the U.S. East Coast, now there is going to be an underlying longer transit. And, you know, I mean, for specific commodities that are time sensitive and, you know, that goes on a JIT demand basis, you know, it might something to be looked at. But really, you know, for the customers that cost savings will be pivotal and can withstand a long transit, I mean, it will end up benefiting them. You know, we've heard of this notion that, hey, you know what, warehousing, you know, there's a cost component to it, but, you know, if you order it in a manner that you're utilizing the long transit as a quote-unquote floating warehouse, really, those are things that, you know, we need to look at and really looking at the supply chain in a very different manner than what we're accustomed to today.
Yeah, no, I absolutely, and I like the fact that you looked at, you know, those different industries, because I think you're right. It is the answer and the impact. It's really going to depend a lot on your industry and what your cost drivers are and what the competitive landscape is and how those trade-off factors, time, cost, flexibility, They're all going to vary by industry and by company, arguably. But I think, highlighting that and showing that in the paper and the research, I think was important, because I think that is a good way to look at it. Just want to remind all of you that, we're kind of coming up short on time here. I've got a couple of more questions left, but if you do have a question for Sri or Jennifer, now is the time to ask it. So Sri, let me stay with you for a second here. Obviously the ocean ports is one thing, but that's part of a broader ecosystem, right? You also have the rail carriers, you have the trucking companies, other transportation modes that can arguably are going to get impacted as well. So how will this shift from the West Coast to the East Coast ports impact rail and trucking operations?
Well, I think, Adrian, we all know, right, the global supply chain. I mean, it co-depends on many different segments, to your point, of transportation. You have the ocean vessels, the barges, the trucks, trains, chassis providers, just to name a few. As such, specific to rail, I mean, we feel that the railroads may need to change their investments, plans to accommodate greater traffic in specific locations, beyond where things are today, and also to continue servicing to the inland market that the expansion might open up to. They might also need to be offering selective discounts to keep traffic moving aggressively to through the US West Coast, as not to lose that balance of traffic that most providers desire. When you look at trucking companies on the US East Coast, they'll definitely open up opportunities to win new traffics and serve new markets. However, I think an important thing to note on that is there needs to be a lot of work done in terms of the truck capacity and also addressing the driver shortages that we so often hear that's plaguing the industry right now.
Those are great points, and it strikes me that one of the challenges that from a transportation standpoint is that the left hand usually doesn't talk to the right hand, meaning that what happens in ocean obviously impacts rail and trucking and vice versa. It would seem to me that those parties, all the stakeholders, including the shippers, ought to be talking together and planning jointly in terms of what these potential future scenarios might mean for each of them respectively, from an investment standpoint, from a coordination standpoint, so on and so forth. So that seems to me kind of an opportunity that ought to be starting now. So along those lines, Jennifer, kind of as a way to wrap up, what actions should shippers, carriers, 3PLs, the ports, take today to kind of prepare for this shift?
It's a good question. So shippers, if I think about shippers, and we come back to kind of the analysis we did on it, the answer varies by what you ship, right? I mean, shippers overall are going to now have more options. So it's not going to just be the West Coast that's competitive. There's going to, the East Coast is going to become more attractive. But that brings complexity as well. And so really needing to look at your portfolio of products that you're bringing over, and asking yourself, where is that breakdown of the trade-off between cost and flexibility and risk in my portfolio that allows me to really optimize bringing what I need to bring in the right time frame at the cheapest cost, and spreading the risk across, back to the Williams-Sonoma comment. I think that's a big thing that companies are thinking about today. And the answer may be different based on the products that I'm bringing in. And so it can't just be a one-stop answer for everything. If I think about carriers, they are going to be faced with essentially thinking about, where do I have capacity? So where am I focusing on capacity growth? Where am I investing in expansion? And am I doing that thinking about the future shifts that may occur to the East Coast, and spending enough time of asset investments and relationships on the East Coast? And then lastly, logistics service providers. I mean, they're, I think, well positioned going forward, because if we go back to the shippers and we think about, them facing a world with broader complexity, more options, logistics service providers are well positioned to step in and really help them manage through that, whether it's, you know, existing customers that they have today, that it will just allow them to strengthen that relationship if they can get out ahead of it, but also potentially new customers that, that are, you know, this is going to be the tipping point for them of complexity that they just say, you know, I'm not going to be able to effectively manage and optimize it myself. I think if you look at logistics service providers and you break them into the ones that are asset-based and non-asset-based, you know, if I'm an asset-based logistics service provider, I really need to look at my network and say, am I adequately represented on the East Coast? And if I'm a non-asset-based provider, you know, you really need to then look at your relationships with the underlying asset providers that you have and saying, am I strong enough on the East Coast? Am I investing enough there? Am I helping them prepare for the inevitable shift in the growth that will come? As well as looking at the portfolio of their own customers and saying, of my customer base, which ones have the type of product portfolio that is more likely to be sensitive to this new cost shift as opposed to others, so they can be very strategic and focused in their support going forward.
Great, Sri, do you have anything to add to that in terms of advice or recommendation or thoughts?
Yeah, I think certainly, you know, Jen provided a good, you know, good recap on what to anticipate. But really, the only few things I'll add to that is really for as far as shippers are concerned, I mean, really embrace the options that the industry will offer, right? I mean, to lower your reliance on specific gateways, as this is the perfect opportunity to create a better, reliable supply chain. You know, most of the customers we talk to lately are not as concerned about how fast the product can get here, but they are more concerned about how reliable and consistent it can get here. So really, we feel strongly that the canal expansion will definitely allow to do this. And, you know, with the Suez Canal as well, you know, competing against the Panama Canal, and this will end up benefiting a lot of customers. And let's not forget, diversity was the key point as well, because you have ILWU on the West Coast, ILA on the U.S. East Coast. 2018 and 19 is when the contracts are expiring. So really, diversity becomes extremely critical. Now, for the carriers, I think that there has to be a lot of discussion that needs to take place, and you know, between the vessel sharing agreements, the large assets that are coming into rotation, the cascading effects from Asia-Europe trade. So really, they need to look at their routing, schedule planning, pricing, the terminal investments, and whatnot. And lastly, the 3PLs. Really, the 3PLs have to play a role in helping customers and also carriers, because you are an intermediary party. So really, you have to help them sort through the options out there and really do what's right for the customer. I mean, a few 3PL, to Jen's point, are asset owners. I mean, they own warehousings and many different things. So maybe it's time to look at, hey, do we need to reallocate to specific location to anticipate the future needs? And, you know, equally as well, on non-asset 3PLs, I mean, you know, making investments in analytical tools, optimization tools. And so really, we need to come out of this mentality that's, hey, what's in it for me? And really think of an industry as you pointed out earlier, Adrian, it really depends on one against, you know, the other. And we really need to look at it from a different lens.
Yeah, great perspectives and words of advice. And of course, you know, the expansion is supposed to go live, I guess, the early part of 2016. So, you know, we're talking about something that's, you know, kind of sooner rather than later here, as opposed to something that's, you know, many years away. So we'll start seeing certainly the impact and some of these scenarios unfold, you know, over the next, you know, year and 18 months or so. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how this ultimately develops. Well, like I always say at the end of every episode, you know, we always manage to kind of scratch the surface on this topic. But, you know, what I recommend folks listening in today, those of you that are attending live as well as watching this on demand, is to download the report. Certainly, we've got the link down on our website on this landing page, so you can click on there. I think it's on the BCG website. I think you can link to it as well from the C.H. Robinson website, and the press release that was announced there. It's a great read. Definitely provides a lot more content and information and background in terms of this analysis. And again, I think it's a good way to kind of get the conversation started internally. If you're a shipper, if you're a carrier, if you're a 3PL, to kind of look through kind of the analysis that was done here and see what questions or ideas kind of emerge from it, from your own reading of it. But again, I just want to take the time to quickly thank Sri and Jennifer for taking the time. Both of you are very busy, I know, but at least taking some time to kind of provide some more color on kind of this this topic and the research you conducted. So Sri, Jennifer, thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us, Adrian. Really appreciate it.
Great. I want to thank everyone who joined us today live. We didn't get any questions, but if you are watching this episode on demand, you can post a question or a comment there at talkinglogistics.com, and I'm sure Sri and Jennifer would be more than happy to respond to any questions or comments via that medium. Again, thank you everyone for joining us, and look forward to seeing you in a future episode of Talking Logistics. Have a great day.